kitchen. There's hard to be raining her do.
Come over here, kid, will you, sir? You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of oil, and you fry some garlic. Then you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. You got it to a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? And a little bit of wine. And a little bit of sugar.
Delicious.
And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
I eat with gusto, damn your bet, my country tis of thee. I eat for social
good
progress.
Evening and welcome to Mouthful, the victory. One country's most delicious hour. It's Michelle and Jordan. Hope you're having a great weekend, and thanks for tuning in. It is, of course, Easter Sunday. It is also the last day of Passover. The Passover, it's full of unusual food and memories about family and heritage and tradition. Tonight, what we're going to do is take an audio tour of what goes into creating a Passover celebration. We'll be visiting a hip-hop seder, a family matzah factory, and a bunch of other interesting things that you might not suspect. But first, we're going to look at the remarkable science and the religious motivation behind the development of our modern calendar. After that, we'll hear a tale of a first Passover, and then a story of how one man, a rabbi, was able to convince Coca-Cola to make Coke kosher.
This week represents a great triumph of scientific learning. Right now, we're between the Jewish Passover feast and the Christian Easter. To develop a calendar that placed these holidays at the same season every year took the work of the best minds in science over 1,500 years to solve. You see, the solar year, the time it takes for the Earth to go around the sun, took a precise 365.2447 days to complete. The position of the Earth relative to the sun determines the seasons, but because of the uneven number of days in the solar year, the season shifted in early calendars. For example, the weather we associate with February slowly crept into March, spelling disaster for humanity. A farmer, for instance, needed to know when to plant or the likely date of the first frost. The Roman Emperor Julius Caesar tried to conquer this problem with a new calendar. He declared the length of a year to be 365 days plus exactly one quarter day. In other words, he rounded that pesky 0.2447 to 0.25. His new calendar, called the Julian calendar, used three 365-day years, plus a 366-day year every fourth year, a kind of leap year. To get the whole Roman world up to par with his new calendar, and to put the world back on track so March would come when March should, he made the year 46 BC 45 days long. He called it Ultimus Annus Confusionis, the year of confusion. But Caesar's clock ran too slow by about 11 minutes, so over a century or so, spring again slowly moved into winter. The next calendar innovation occurred because of religion. The vernal equinox, the date when the hours of daylight equal those of darkness, determined the dates of Easter and Passover. The Jewish authorities used a lunar calendar to determine the date of the vernal equinox, but the Catholic Pope didn't want to depend on another religion to determine the Christian Easter. So, in the late 16th century, Pope Gregory assembled a council to survey the best scientific work of the time and of the previous centuries, including Copernicus's earth-shattering observations about the motion of the planets. The Pope charged his council with finding the exact length of the solar year and then match a calendar to it. They came up with a calendar based on a year only 26 seconds short of the true length of a solar year. They invented a calendar with months containing varying number of days and the occasional leap year, the calendar we use today. In many ways, our science today descends from this calendar, because the search for a new calendar helped keep alive mathematics and astronomy in a time less than ideal for scientific inquiry. kept alive not though by a love of learning, but to solve an administrative problem of the Pope.
On April 16th of this year, I was in Los Angeles and was subsequently tossed neck deep into my first Passover experience. My fiancé Mark is a Jew who loves both Bacon and Seinfeld equally. Although he rarely sees the inside of a temple, he still feels it's important to uphold his family's traditions. The Seder dinner is the big one. "It's the culture, not the religion," he says. As a lapsed Methodist and a practicing hedonist, I understand completely. While my quasi-kosher fiancé is more than happy to let me be as shiksatastic as possible, we both agreed that we would raise our offspring Jewish. Though the more orthodox folk may find that impossible, our lesbian rabbi swears on the Torah that we can pull it off. I spent 2 days helping my future mother-in-law, Fega, prepare the Passover dinner. I paid attention, knowing that someday soon I would be called upon to prove that I had the matzah balls to pull off a Seder of my own. As we set the table, I mentioned that I liked her china very much. "Good," Fega said. "You get it when I die. Remember, you're marrying my only child." Luckily, I like the silverware also. Apparently, I get that too. Like most Gentiles, I have found Jewish cuisine to be a mystery and a possible oxymoron. But I admit that my knowledge of it was limited to offhanded comments made by others. I have heard matzah referred to as the tie that binds, not just because of its prevalence in Jewish culture, but also because of its powerful constipating properties. And I'll never forget someone telling me that gefilte fish was the bologna of the sea. But in the kitchen, I learned plenty. I learned that you want to make matzah balls kind of small, or else they swell to the size of a baseball and are more dense than a presidential debate. I learned you should use schmaltz, which is rendered chicken fat, instead of vegetable oil for a more authentic taste. Most importantly, I learned that the dishwasher was broken, so when we get the house after Fega dies, we should fix it. When everybody arrived, we performed the rituals as fast as possible in order to start the feasting. We stopped only to laugh, in disbelief, at Mark's 93-year-old grandmother's surprisingly convincing Hitler imitation, complete with heels and a finger mustache. We all fought for the breast meat of the turkey, while Fega claimed the gorgel, which is Yiddish for the neck. Mark said that over 40 years in the desert can lead people to bizarre eating habits. Everybody laughed, but I didn't get the joke. I think it was a Jewish thing. Now, Mark's family taught me the basics of Passover. They tried to tell me the differences between their religion and the religion I was raised in. But actually, I only saw the commonalities. I saw a group of people that loved each other and got together to celebrate and to complain whenever they want. And having a holiday just makes it more special. I felt that I was part of his family now. As we ate, I looked at the Seder plate. It was beautiful. It was made of silver and had Hebrew words etched into it. I knew I better learn what those words meant, because I was going to inherit that plate someday.
This story is a story about this great Rabbi Geffen, this Lithuanian rabbi who came to Atlanta and was able to infiltrate the inner sanctum of Coca-Cola. It's also the story of Coca-Cola, the fact that American Jews needed to drink Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola was the American drink. And if Coca-Cola was the American drink and the Jews came to America and they became American Jews, how could an American Jew not drink Coca-Cola? In the early 1930s, there were rabbis from around the country who began to send letters to Rabbi Geffen, asking Rabbi Geffen whether Coca-Cola was kosher. He was the rabbi in Atlanta. They figured that he would know. Rabbi Geffen's initial contact with the Coca-Cola executives was through a Jew who lived in Atlanta by the name of Harold Hirsch. Harold Hirsch was an attorney. He was the attorney for Coca-Cola. Rabbi Geffen approached Mr. Hirsch and explained that here is the issue. Unless he is told the ingredients of Coca-Cola, he will have no choice but to declare Coca-Cola not kosher. Mr. Hirsch approached the executives of Coca-Cola, told them about what Rabbi Geffen wanted, and set up a meeting between some of the executives of Coca-Cola and Rabbi Geffen. It seems that actually the executives from Coca-Cola paid Rabbi Geffen a visit in his home. They gave Rabbi Geffen the ingredients of Coca-Cola. And Rabbi Geffen found that there were two ingredients that were problematic, according to Jewish law. The first ingredient was glycerin, which comes from animal fat. And animal fat is needs to be kosher. The second was an ingredient that was problematic only for Passover, when a Jew is not allowed to consume bread, and that was grain alcohol. Grain is considered to be like bread. He was able to convince the executives of Coca-Cola to change these two ingredients and to make Coca-Cola kosher. Rabbi Geffen wrote this in a letter that he sent to the rabbis around the country because he wanted to publicize the fact that Coca-Cola was kosher. It seems that in the initial letter that he wrote, he identified these two ingredients, glycerin and grain alcohol, as being problematic. He sent the letter to this Mr. Hirsch, and Mr. Hirsch sent a letter to Rabbi Geffen. He says, the letter is fine, but I would appreciate if you did not mention the ingredients of Coca-Cola. So instead, he used an old rabbinic word which referred to some kind of herb that they used in the time of the temple, Muris and Anigrod, which are these arcane, old-fashioned words that only the greatest rabbinic scholar would understand. But that was his way of identifying the fact that there were ingredients, and he was able to replace the ingredients. He could have said Coca-Cola is not kosher. It wasn't kosher. He could have said Coca-Cola is not kosher. But he understood that his responsibility to American Judaism was not to say that American Jews are sinners, that they're drinking something that's not kosher. His job was to make sure that what American Jews were doing was actually rabbinically accepted. And that's why he went out of his way to make sure Coca-Cola was kosher.
Listening to Mouthful's Passover Special. Now we're going to take a look at a family matzah business, followed by a vegan in Alaska, and the story of a hip-hop Haggadah with a Canadian DJ named So-Called. It's all here on Mouthful.
Even fresh out of the oven, matzah tastes dry and hard. But the simple doughy flavor seems a bit more bread-like and touch tastier than it is off the supermarket shelf. But that subtle taste distinction doesn't explain why New Yorkers come from miles around to buy their matzah direct from the Streitz factory here on Manhattan's Lower East Side. The family history also sells. Customer Gloria Cohen of Long Island is buying the new organic matzah today.
I stop in here, it's a place to buy, you know, it has the old-fashioned flavor, and the matzahs are still baked here, as you can hear.
You can see them
coming out. You know, I like to take my grandchildren here to see that this is how food was made in New York.
If you peek past the register through the factory door, you can see four men called matzah pickers at work. They're grabbing the broad sheets of matzah as it comes off the oven's conveyor belt, then cracking them into squares and stacking them for packaging. Pretty close to what you might have seen if you shopped here in the 1920s, when Aaron Streit opened the factory with his son Irvin.
They started as pretty much a local bakery where people would wait online around the block to buy matzah.
That's Alan Adler, great-grandson of Aaron Streit. Adler manages the daily operations of the business along with two other cousins, out of the very same office his grandfather Irving used when he ran the business with his brother Jack.
This is not a fancy office. The only thing that's changed is Irving and Jack used to smoke about two boxes of cigars a day, and the wood in the office absorbed the cigar smell, and it took about 10 or 20 years to get rid of it.
The sense of history can be thicker than the matzah here, that's for sure. Portraits of Aaron and of his sons adorn the walls, providing a constant reminder of the family roots, now that the cigar smoke is gone. But the business doesn't survive on nostalgia alone. True, the baking methods have remained mostly unchanged since the factory opened here in 1925, but that's because they still work.
We have some old movies from the 30s, and the machinery looks amazingly like it does now.
To show me, he takes me across the hallway and up a flight of stairs to the mixing room. A small crowd of mostly bearded men is huddled around two giant metal mixing drums that look a bit like overgrown milkshake machines.
First they put the flour in the drum, as you just saw. Now they put the water hose into the drum. It's lifted up into the mixer, and the blade will then start mixing.
Today they're making the very expensive shmura matzah that meets very strict specifications and ultra-orthodox standards. Shmura means watched over or guarded in Hebrew, and that explains the crowd, because every step from grain growth to harvest, from the drawing of the water to the precise baking requirements, is observed and certified by a rabbi, or several.
Every time we do the shmura, I always want to take a picture and caption it. How many rabbis does it take to make a matzah? Because as you can see, but the listeners can't. There are three workers and 9 rabbis.
Some of them are apprentice observers, but before I can talk to any of them, Adler races off down a rickety staircase through a hole in the floor.
And the machine just stopped now?
Yeah.
There's a problem at the next step of the baking process.
How much did you get out?
I ask one of the rabbis if I can follow.
Are you able to?
Yeah, sure.
And down the stairs I go. I see the oven. It's 75 feet long, stretching the length of the building, and looks something like a small metal tunnel. Before the dough slides into the oven on a conveyor belt, it passes through a dangerous-looking machine with four thick rollers and a few rotating blades.
This is the matzah forming machine. It's called a sheeter. The big rollers flatten the dough, and then the knives perforate it and put it into the right shape and size. The problem we're having now is that this dough for the shmura matzah was very soft and was sticking, so they were having problems getting it through the machine in time.
Time is short because kosher matzah dough needs to be baked in less than 18 minutes. Rabbi Meir Kirshner is carefully watching a digital timer.
I make sure that when the process starts and the water hits the flour, that we start the 16-minute timer. And then when the 16-minute timer ends, I put a little mark to know that that's the last bit that's going to go through the oven, which takes a little under 2 minutes. And by the time that mark ends at the exit of the oven, that we know it's 18 minutes. And we're finished baking that run.
After 18 minutes, the dough could rise on its own, and then it wouldn't be matzah. Right now, a worker moves frantically around the forming machine, wielding a 2-foot-long wrench, turning bolts on all sides. He's adjusting the pressure on the rollers to let as much dough into the oven as he can in the right thickness before the time is up.
Yeah, the pressure on the rollers is adjusted from each end, and it's adjusted by feel. That was whistling to the other end of the oven so they can adjust the oven speed properly. Now, with new modern equipment, the rollers would be adjustable by the push of a button.
On the other end of the oven, the matzah pickers I saw before are cracking and stacking the matzah into mini elevators, heading off to the packaging room upstairs where it's boxed for shipping. This shmura batch made it there just fine, in case you were worried. But the more I hear Alan Adler explain the process and the machinery here, the more I realize the trade-offs his family has to grapple with. Preserving tradition and heritage isn't always compatible with running the most profitable business possible.
It's not that easy or efficient making matzah on 6 different floors in 4 different buildings in the middle of Manhattan. We don't have modern loading docks here. People are walking on the sidewalks, but we have a long history with the Lower East Side, and until we can no longer do it, we're going to be here doing it.
They could make matzah in nearby New Jersey with more modern equipment. They could sell the Manhattan land for condominiums and get a hefty chunk of change. But they haven't, and Adler says they won't. Over the past few years, the 11 family members with shared ownership debated all the options and decided to keep Streit's where it's been for almost a century. Impressive, considering that most family businesses don't last past the third generation.
So it was really pretty amazing when 11 of us could unanimously agree that we did not want to sell a business, that we did not want to have some Israeli company pack the matzah for us and just become a marketing concern.
Still, there is change afoot. They have a second plant now that makes a whole line of Jewish foods. And Adler tells me the year-round matzah business keeps growing. So if you're in need of a good crunch any time of year, matzah is not just for Passover anymore.
We take pride in what we do. We have a heritage that we want to live up to. We believe we have a better tasting product. And we all agreed we wanted to continue in the family business for another few generations.
So two Chinese guys walk out of a Jewish restaurant, and one of them says to the other, "The problem with Jewish food is that 2 days later, you're hungry again." I heard this joke recently, and I laughed until I plotzed. Because, well, let's put it this way. Jewish cuisine isn't exactly the next Jenny Craig, nor is it the next South Beach, even if 10% of America's Jews do happen to live, work, and swap shop in Broward, Miami-Dade, and Palm Beach counties. Take eggs and sibilis, for example. This mishmash of hard-boiled eggs, onion, and chicken fat, or schmaltz, easily packs enough cholesterol to clog the entire Trans-Alaska pipeline, all 800 miles of it. Gribenous chicken skin fried in schmaltz would send your garden variety dietitian cowering beneath the salad bar. And a heaping helping of kugel, noodle pudding crammed with cottage cheese, cream cheese, sour cream, butter, and eggs, is such stuff a vegan's nightmares are made on. And I should know. I've been a vegan for about 2 years now. When I put an end to meat, eggs, and dairy, I also put the kibosh on thousands of years of culinary convention. As I let the blintzes and brisket go, I had, in a way, let my people go, too. For, you see, to many Jews, noshing is a sacrament. From the Passover Seder to the Yom Kippur Break the Fast feast, the bulk of our holidays revolve around two things: attending temple and attending to the tummy. On Rosh Hashanah, we sweeten the new year with gooey honey cake. On Purim, we fress on triangular fruit-filled Humantashen cookies. And my mother still drools over memories of Sabbath dinners at her Bubby Razel's house. Her pint-sized grandmother stirring yet another cauldron of chicken soup, all the while chiming out in Yiddish, "Es, es, gesinter heit. Eat, eat to your heart's content." But ever since I bid shalom to the chicken and chopped liver, the gefilte fish, and the gribbiness, I haven't been able to follow my great-grandmother's decree, at least not in the way she intended. Had I turned to tofu while Bubby Razel was still around? I can just imagine the tumult, the uproar. One tiny hand clasping a skillet of schmaltz, the other grasping my shoulder, that 4-foot-5-inch dynamo would stare up at me through her rhinestone-studded horn rims and cry, "What? No chicken soup? What kind of cockamamie mishigas is this? Oy, bubbala." Even though kosher laws forbid the mixing of milk and meat, for a vegan such as myself, traditional Jewish meals aren't exactly a piece of cake, be it honey, streusel, or kosher for Passover. It's helped that in recent years, my little sister Katie, clearly the chosen one for carrying on Bubby Razel's mass-feeding legacy, has brewed up a mean, poultry-free chicken soup. And last Yom Kippur, when I journeyed home for my family's Break the Fast dinner, my heart and my taste buds leapt when, alongside the usual trillion-calorie smorgasbord of knishes, kugel, and blintz souffle, I spied a bowl of Katie's latest invention, tofu egg salad, perfect for a schmear on a hot and vegan everything bagel. Now, don't get me wrong. The heartiest noshers will tell you there's nothing in the world like a slice of fresh-baked babka or a hot pastrami and mustard on rye. But in the eyes of this here bubbala, it's what happens around the table that truly makes the meal. Gone are the days when the entire family would slurp chicken soup at Bubby Razel's house each Friday night. Kibitzing face-to-face has been replaced by emailing state-to-state. So, the way I see it, the most scrumptious thing of all isn't necessarily the food, no matter how tasty that tofu egg salad is. It's that chance. Increasingly rare as our kith and kin spread like so much cream cheese across the country and world, for all of us to come to the table, take a seat, take a bite, and simply be together again, essing and essing to our heart's content.
Drink.
We're closed. Nice people don't drink on Pesach. They go to the synagogue.
And the Lord.
I didn't even think there would be an audience for it when I started it. It was basically for me and like my family and my friends. I never thought it would really get out into the public. When I started making it, probably over 5 years ago, I certainly wasn't thinking I was going to be a professional musician, that this was going to be my life. And then when I started giving it out to people, this little demo version of it, people just really loved it. You're supposed to tell the Passover story every year as if it's happening to you this year. I'm not religious at all, but I do care about traditions and cultural history. So this was my way to make the Passover story of getting out of slavery feel real.
Let's go and pass out the Passover. It's a party, so come on and bring your ass over. It's my fourth because I kicked my fifth glass over. Hurry up because it sucks to be the last over. I wine and dine and I...
Hip-hop is actually uniquely well-suited to make people curious to explore their own tradition a little bit, because you actually got these bits embedded in the new music. The idea of like mixing Jewish music and fat beats is not supposed to be funny. That's just supposed to be dope and like supposed to make you go, oh yeah. I mean, there's definitely a sense of humor, I hope, present in the production. But there's also serious issues implied in the whole thing, because I think we have to rediscover these sort of forgotten voices from our past and our culture and the music and the and that tradition.
Thanks for tuning in. It's Michelle Jordan here on Mouthful, and I really hope you're enjoying tonight's stories, whether they resonate with things in your past or are introducing you to a whole new part of the culture you didn't know about before. Next, we're going to hear the Gefilte Fish Chronicles, and I think that promises a pretty good time. After that, it will be a look at the Passover candy store in New York's Lower East Side.
The great thing, I must tell you, about this tradition, it's approximately 100 people. If you have a friend, you don't need permission. You just call and say, "Aunt Pep, I'm bringing. Come ahead." I always say, "I'll put another cup of water in the soup. Come ahead." It is a tremendous amount of work. It is a production. It starts Purim, when I peel 25 pounds of beets and put them in crocks and ferment them. I create 18 pounds of horseradish root and make chicken soup from 18 chickens, gallons hands and garments too.
No, it doesn't need salt, Pesci.
Okay.
Well, maybe just... No, I'm...
No, it doesn't.
I don't think
it's tradition. And when you walk through the floor, you say, how's the fish today? And you say, okay, give me a piece, I'll test it. The fish is made from 75 pounds of fish. And we chopped that fish till you could make a patty of it, drop it in the hot sauce. Tell you the truth, you never taste anything more delicious. Oh, it's delightful. It is traditional that we have chullen. Now, chullen is an Eastern European the immigrants brought with them. Chullen cooks for 24 hours.
Chullen truly represents putting everything in one pot, mixing it up well.
Attaboy, Stephen, attaboy.
Putting it in with love and care and attention. And it's really representative of our family. When you come into the house and we are cooking, we happen to be very verbal, as you know.
You have to put the meat in.
Well, how are we going to put the meat in?
Where are you going to put the knedla?
Well, what do you want from me? We'll find a spot for the knedla.
And heard us cooking, you would say they'll never survive the day.
So, fire me. I'm waiting to be fired.
Now it's knedel time, da-da-da, knedel time.
Don't forget, this has to...
We were seven sisters and one brother. And it's hard for me to even say it. The only sibling left is my twin sister. But I'm happy to say that it goes on. When I'm gone, I know that will go on because I already have the girls working.
We're about to start the Seder and formally bring in the Pesach. Please join as we light the candles.
For 55 years, Grandpa led the Seder. And then for the next 38 years...
It doesn't matter what your religion is. Your papa, practice it. Make a tradition that nothing supersedes. Start remembering every holiday is a treasure. You should keep it and share it.
This is a podcast of nextbook.org. Your source for Jewish literature, culture, and ideas. Today, we're like a kid in the candy store. I'm standing here in Economy Candy. It's a candy store on the Lower East Side. We got one wall that's full of jars. Jars of bazooka gum, atomic fireballs, peanut crunch, yogurt-dipped raisins. And I'm standing here with Jerry Cohen. Jerry's the son of the guy who founded Economy Candy. It was founded in 1937. And I'm here to talk with Jerry about Passover candy. Why don't you just sort of describe it for us?
All right. Well, we have the whole line of Bartons, Buttercrunch, Mini Matzahs, Lolly Cones, Almond Kisses, which has been handed down from generation to generation. That the can is always the same. They don't change that can. Chocolate-covered matzah from Bartons, Seder Mints. Of course, then you have Joyba products, the jelly rings, the vanilla twist, the cherry twist, raspberry gels.
So, how much Passover candy are you moving through here every season?
Bartons, we go through 500 cases. We sell a ton of macaroons.
Do you sell a lot of different kinds of macaroons, or just what flavors do you carry?
Basically now we're down to two, the chocolate-covered macaroons and the plain coconut macaroons. At one point in time when Paso was huge, we'd have pina colada, all different flavors. But
pina colada.
Pina colada macaroons. Mm-hmm.
Now, I read somewhere that actually it was a Jewish person who invented Peeps, marshmallow Peeps.
I'm sure.
And you've got the Peeps right next to the ringtails.
We have the Peeps, yes. Hand in hand.
And so if everybody, you know, for, I guess there's something for everybody.
It makes a good treat, you know, to put on your Seder plate, the marshmallow Peep.
And how does Easter compare to Passover in terms of...
I love selling the chocolate bunnies. You know, especially when they're broken because I get to eat the ears, the chocolate ears.
Do you eat a lot of candy?
I don't stop eating candy. I go around in the morning, taste everything, and make sure it's good for public consumption.
And when it comes to Passover candy, what do you like? What
Nothing.
Really?
I don't like any Passover candy.
Why not?
It has a different taste, and you know, it just is, I like my basics, my almond bark, my butter crunch, my chunky bars.
And so the Passover candy, just because what's missing from it?
These days, nothing is missing from it. It's all made just under strict supervision by the rabbis.
Sure.
But you could buy anything you want today for Passover.
Do you have any kosher for Passover Easter bunnies?
No, but we do have kosher bunnies. Not for Passover, though.
How about you have kosher chocolate bunnies?
Kosher, we have chocolate bunnies. Mm-hmm. Even candy canes are kosher these days, too.
I didn't realize that. That's great. And if you were to do kosher for Passover, you'd have to do some things around here, too, right?
We'd have to, get my feather, get my candle, get my little duster, and, you know, look for all the chametz.
Why do people eat fruit slices?
Oh, they're delicious.
Really?
Especially when they're fresh, like we have them. They are sweet. They are good to get you through the day.
Could I taste one of those?
If you'd like to.
Yeah.
Sure, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Have a fruit slice.
And so I see you have not just the packaged ones, but you have like a big bin of them. And so
we sell tons of fruit slices.
And do you make them, or where are you getting these from?
No. This is a private... Well, we haven't made for us, and we can't make everything these days anymore. You know, it's very expensive to have property in Manhattan. You can't have machinery here. So everything's made for us elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. And so, because I've only had the packaged ones, and when I get the packaged fruit slices, they're...
Well, the packaged ones are made 6 months behind. These are made weekly.
Mm-hmm. So what's your favorite flavor?
The red.
If you don't mind, I'm going to taste one.
Well, that's watermelon, though.
Oh, this is watermelon. So it's red with a green rind.
Oh, red with the cherry and raspberry.
Why don't you have one of these? But I'm going to try one of the red.
There you go.
Okay.
You can even bite into it, right?
You're right. It's much fresher. Much better.
The softer and the good consistency. Mm-hmm. Another very famous thing is toasted coconut marshmallows.
Toasted coconut marshmallows.
A white marshmallow with toasted coconut flakes on top, which is also a traditional favorite.
Now, this kind of thing, the toasted marshmallows, doesn't move the rest of the year, or you don't carry these the rest of the year?
No, the rest of the year it doesn't move.
And fruit slice is true?
Fruit slice all year long.
All year long?
All year long. You saw the picture over there in the corner?
No, show us the picture.
My dad and I, when I was a young boy, I think I was about 9 years old in this picture here, of the store where it used to be.
And how old were you when you started working in the store?
At birth. You know, minute the next day, there I was in my carriage in the back end of the store, and my sisters also the same way. You know, we all were in, it's a family business. My mother, my father, and my two sisters. Even our kids were brought into the business to work.
Uh-huh. And so are there any of them here now? Or?
No, my son now is in University of Pennsylvania, Wharton School. But he started out on a milk box, working the register, giving change, and things like that.
So part of, is your son gone off to Wharton to figure out how to take over the world with candy? Or
He's going to be another Donald Trump there. You know, it's a beautiful business. You work hard, you make a lot of money, and you meet a lot of people. I mean, he could take it and open up a chain of stores if he wants, or just keep one store and be very happy with it.
All right, well, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
This is great, and we're going to pick up some candy for the office, too, we go. So we're
Sounds good to me.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Pleasure. So I want to get a pound of fruit slices and a pound of the chocolate-covered macaroons. Jerry Cohen is the owner of Economy Candy, which is on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. It's right across the street from the swanky new hotel on Rivington. It's this glass, monstrosity. But Jerry's keeping up with the times. He supplies the snack counter there.
$14.97.
And you can also find Economy Candy on the web at www.economycandy.com.
Thank you very much.
For Next Book, I'm Blake Eskin. Thanks for listening.
Tonight's special edition of Mouthful concludes with a play that was part of Pegasus Theater's Tapas presentation of one-act plays by local playwrights. This one looks at three generations of Jewish women cooking soup together.
Borscht soup in the mornings. That was Bubba Sarah. Dark rye bread, sour cream. My grandmother. I tried her soup once. I must have been 6 or 7, thinking I'd like it because it was such a pretty pink. Cold pureed beets. Ugh, nasty. But at least she could cook.
You think good food tastes good? Food is to make strong. Every day I eat this, my mother showed me. Trick is to grind beets in large bowl, making lots of little beets. Then cook till becoming soup, pinch of salt, pepper, some milk to thicken. Every day like this. 93 years. And not once do I like the taste. People adjust?
She was 16 when she came to the Americas.
Actually, I was 15.
A real Russian peasant.
I was peasant. My family worked on farm, not just any farm. Farm of great family.
Her people were serfs on the farm of a famous Russian family.
A great name.
Our literary roots run deep. We shoveled horse-ish for the Tolstoys.
People adjust.
She made the crossing in 1900 by boat. Can you imagine? And only 16?
15, actually. Well, more than 15, but less than 16. Much closer to 15. And I did alone.
I can't even send my kids to school by themselves.
It was beautiful boat. The night Scotsman. I take train from Moscow to Marseille. I thought it funny. English boat sailing from France to go to America. My first multicultural undertaking. And I did great thing on boat.
She taught the ship's cook to make borscht. She was just a kid. Like I said, Bubba Sarah could work the kitchen. Not like...
My Jenny, your mother. She never learned cooking. She makes soup once, some funny-looking noodle.
Frozen tortellini. Didn't even cook it. Just poured the package on top of a bed of iceberg lettuce and served with pine nuts.
Eat, eat, eat. That's what we do. Nobody starved in my house. Besides, I was a war child. Born during the first, come to age during the second, with a depression in between. Who had time to cook fancy?
There is one thing, though, that we have in common.
Soups.
Soups?
The women in our family make soups like nobody's business.
Cupboards full of nothing and an empty fridge.
They always do this.
Make something out of nothing.
It's in blood.
People even eat my soups, and they're not just being polite.
Family always making soup. Back to before one could remember. Program, no food, make soup. Shore, no food, make soup. Purges, no food, make soup. We survive. Women in family love all kinds of soups.
Except borscht.
Except borscht.
People adjust.
There are no recipes. Nothing's written down. It's all in our heads.
And in our hearts.
Who has time to write things down?
It'd be nice. My girl's having recipes from Bubba Sarah.
I never learn writing. Russian, Yiddish, English, no writing. But I speak all three.
I miss the language. I grew up with it. Day to day, it was Yiddish in the house and Russian when Mama and Papa got mad.
Good curses in Russian. Strong and to point. Plus, don't want disrespect mother tongue making bed talk.
I never knew the language. I heard people when I was young. They used it to say stuff they didn't want me to hear.
After Papa died, Mama refused to use it. In English, she'd say. You American girls speak in English. The language was their link to the old world. And when Papa died, I think she wanted to keep that special for herself.
Actually, I love learning English. Watching television, what you call soap opera. Strange name, I think. No soap, no singing. But shows lots of fun. And the women, maybe not so good at making soups, but very good at making trouble.
Mom told me a great Bubba Sarah story about when Mom got married.
We didn't have any money. Who did at that age? So, of course, my Jack and I had decided to live with my parents in the spare bedroom upstairs. You know, save up some money of our own so we could get a nice place.
Mom and Dad loved to save money. And it wasn't that they were cheap. I can't count the number of times they've helped us. No, they just loved to bargain. And coupons.
Found money, if you ask me.
They'd cut coupons and head out to the drugstore to buy whatever item was on sale. Batteries, Bic pens.
We came up in hard times. People couldn't find work in the 30s, let alone feed their families. We had to use ration cards during the war. Can you imagine?
Then they'd go to a different store the next day, coupons in hand, for more pens and batteries. It didn't matter. We had a drawer already packed with double A's, C's, D's, whatever.
My daughter doesn't understand.
Coupon shopping was entertainment for them. Taking their time with it all afternoon, picking out just the right pens, they shopped like turtles, slow and steady.
I thought we were talking about my wedding night.
Very special night for a lady. Maybe not so much today, but back then, it when lady discover how does soup say it? If men you spend the rest of your life with, good in sec.
Papa Sarah had these bells, a string of sleigh bells attached to a leather strap.
And we get into bed at the end of what any bride will tell you is a very long day.
With Papa and me downstairs, listening and giggling like schoolchildren.
And when we, start to, Well, she had tied those freaking bells
to the mattress underneath the bed.
And we hear jingle, jingle, jingle.
Jack was mortified. He wanted to move out that night. I told him, where can we go?
Next day at breakfast, Papa and me
kept singing jingle bells and breaking out in peals of laughter.
Finally, Dad, Mom's brand new bridegroom, shouts,
enough with the Christmas song, we're Jewish already.
And you know what Bubba Sarah told him?
People are just.
There was lots of Russian in the house that morning.
Feminine family might not write things down.
And we don't always agree on what makes a great soup.
But there is one recipe we all agree on.
List of ingredients most necessary.
In that all-important main course.
Men. He's got to have more than just a pinch of humor to survive in our family.
He's got to give love, as much as we give, and more.
Must like soups.
And family, children.
And let's not forget the secret ingredient.
Must be good in sec.
People are just... We've all worked Love's Kitchen just fine.
I married for 68 years.
63 for Jack and me.
Most years happy ones.
Just had my 20th anniversary.
Some sad, some angry. All of them worth it.
Good marriage like good soup. Keep mixing ingredients, changing recipe, when taste changes. When need sweet, add sugar. If too bland, add spice.
The women in our family are great. I miss and love the ones who have left. We lost Baba Sarah when I was 16. The same age she was when she came over from Russia.
Actually, I was 15.
My mom moved in with us after Dad passed. She argued it would be too much bother looking after a doting old woman. But I had her cold, telling her the same thing she said when Baba Sarah moved into Mom's house.
We don't do nursing homes in this family.
I've two girls of my own. I teach them soup and tell them the old stories. Bubba Sarah's journey across. The letter Dad sent Mom while they were engaged.
He wrote, I love you, but I can't marry you. I'm too much of a hedonist to settle down with one woman. I knew then he had that special ingredient.
Someday, I'd like to write it all down. The stories, the soups, even the borscht. Get it on paper for my kids. I never seem to get around to it, but I'm not really worried they'll miss anything. Like Bubba Sarah used to say, it's in our blood. There is one story, though, that I'm saving. Like I said, my daughters are young, and those sleigh bells are in the back of my closet waiting. People adjust.
We heard the play Turtle Shopping by Scott Murrow. Turtle Shopping was originally produced by Pegasus Theater for its one-act play celebration, Tapas. It was originally directed by Darlene Wilson with actors Wally Cass, Lois Pearlman, and Mandy Cimino. You're listening to a special edition of Mouthful with Michelle Anna Jordan. It's KRCB Radio 91 FM. that wraps up tonight's special presentation here on Mouthful. Thanks so much for staying tuned. Next week, I have a really exciting show. Sally Fallon, the founding president of the Weston A. Price Foundation, is going to join us from the East Coast. And here in the studio, it will be Ann Fisher Silva, a local nutritionist and head of the local chapter of the Weston A. Price Foundation. This is nutritional information. Really fun, really exciting, really compelling. You don't want to miss it. So have a great week and meet me back here next week for another yummy episode of Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour.
Just say it.